now a blank page. Make your stand.
And you don't worry about a thing. Cause every little thing's gonna be alright.
I'm scared.
Me too.
Where will we go?
Welcome to the Boulder Free Zone. Stu Redmond. Which one of you is Larry Underwood?
How do you know who I am?
How do you think?
Mother Abigail?
All I know is that we dreamed of her and she was real.
She brought us all together to keep us safe in these uncertain times.
This is my message to you.
I am in the way of knowing things.
I know you feel him.
Calls himself the Dark Man. Mostly I just see his wolf.
Mother Abigail told us that there are two sides to the world. There's the good. And then there's a deep well of darkness.
Their time is at an end. Our time has begun.
There's bitter days ahead. Death and terror.
The Dark Man grows stronger every day.
And soon he'll destroy all who stand against him. The world is now a blank page. And it is there. You must make your stand.
Hello, welcome to the second edition of our The Stand novel episode. This is a episode that will be part of two podcasts. And then we switch over to one after this podcast. This is the Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews podcast. It's a two episode book review, I guess, of The Stand, the novel by Stephen King,
and the uncut version.
Yes, the uncut version. Absolutely. Especially since we're about to give the title of the other podcast that people will find us under, which will be Don't Tell Me, I'll Tell You, The Stand podcast, which will be more based on the CBS All Access television miniseries, which starts late December 2020 and runs to February 2021. So we're basically reviewing the book for the first two episodes, and then we're going to head right into the TV miniseries. And each week we will have a new episode of the new episode of Don't Tell Me, I'll Tell You, The Stand podcast to discuss each episode of the miniseries on CBS All Access. And that's supposed to be an 8-episode season, I think, but things have been changing around. News have been changed and whatnot. We'll talk about some of it. Barrett actually just brought some up to me right prior to starting this recording. But before we begin, for folks who are curious who found us, we are part of the Dark Discussions Network of podcasts. So it's basically an all-genre website where you can find all your horror and genre news. So movies, books, video games, anime, whatever. We have numerous articles, columns, podcasts, and whatnot. That is darkdiscussions.com, www.darkdiscussions.com. We are also, this feed here will be found two spots, but basically two RSS feeds, but in multiple spots. So wherever you find podcasts, you'll find this podcast here. But the feed to search us under will be Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews, but more importantly, Don't Tell Me, I'll Tell You, The Stand podcast. So just search for that on Apple Podcasts or whatever, and you will find us and you can hear us weekly. We do like audience participation, and that is basically through mostly emails, but audio files are fine too, WAVE or MP3s or whatever. And basically, you can email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com or press the contact us link on www.darkdiscussions.com and send your emails to us, and we will read your emails or include your audio files that you attach to emails on the next episode of the podcast. So your thoughts on The Stand, the book, Stephen King, the miniseries, The Changes, the original TV miniseries, anything related to The Stand, and less specifically Stephen King, we will read on the podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Hey, this is Barrett.
Barrett, how's it going?
It's going well.
Excellent. So even though folks are going to be listening to these podcasts in December, leading right up to the beginning of the Stand miniseries or whatever it's called on CBS All Access, the first episode, this is the second episode of this podcast, was actually recorded how many months ago? 4 months ago, maybe?
It was 4 months ago, and then things intervened, and we weren't able to get the second half done right away.
Yeah, and we weren't rushing it, because after we recorded it, because we were originally just going to do an episode on the novel, and then out of the blue, we discovered that the miniseries was coming up, and neither myself or Barrett really knew much about it or even knew when it was coming. And then when we heard that it was coming in December, we said, oh, why don't we just add the book review to the beginning of our podcast on the TV show. And we thought that was a good idea. And since the TV show wasn't coming out for another 5 months or so after we recorded episode one, we didn't feel the need to immediately record episode two. And so that's why there's such a large gap between the two episodes in recording time. That was an interesting curiosity. That's the wonders of podcasting, I guess, right?
Yeah. Kind of worked out nicely that we'll be able to throw it in front of the new show. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So basically we got here, this is, like I said, there's two for the book, and we're also going to talk about in this episode here the feelings of what we heard and what we think is going to happen in the miniseries, changes and all that stuff. And then we'll do 8 more episodes after that for basically to discuss each episode of the CBS All Access miniseries. And then maybe, depending on how everything goes, we'll do a 11th episode, which would be just a wrap-up of our final thoughts on everything related to The Stand. And any other interesting news about Stephen King can be added on that episode, too. But we'll determine it, you know, if the show's not that good, or if we pretty much covered everything in each episode and there's nothing to really report for a wrap-up episode, we'll just forget it. But we'll find out in February as we get to then. Assuming there isn't a Stand and we're all wiped out before then.
Yeah. You know,
China's always waiting.
Yeah.
All right. So general stuff. What would you want to bring up? Anything you got to say, Barrett? You haven't spoken much because most of this was just a house cleaning introduction and all that wonderful stuff.
Not too much for this, for the book part of it. You know, I'll have probably a little more to say on the other end, the miniseries.
Sure. So, yeah. So, depending on how long we go, I can't see us going any more than 2 hours, but either way, I think we'll probably do half and half, right? Half on the second part of the book, and then the other half about our, I guess, the preamble to our feelings on the miniseries that's going to come up, which will be the episode next week, because by the time people hear this, this will be released the week before the miniseries starts, and then we're going to just go right a weekly after that. All right. So we were talking in the prior episode mostly about the first half of the book, the pre-apocalypse imp and the fall of society. And that, I think we both agree, was the best part of the book, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It right up until they reach Mother Abigail, I think, is really the best part of the book. And I'm not saying the rest is bad, but I'm just saying that is my favorite part of the book.
Sure. Yeah, I would agree. I think I felt where they meet Mother Abigail is pretty cool. And then there's still some stuff with Nick, because he has to go, he's behind the rest of the characters. So that part's pretty good. So that's still part of the first half of the book. And then, of course, when Trash Can Man meets the kid, and that's still part of that book. And then after all that, once the two groups land in their final destinations, which happen to be, I believe, Boulder, Colorado, and Las Vegas, Nevada, that's, I guess, where we would consider the second part of the book to occur.
Yeah, the rebuilding part and with what's left.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I guess that's where I don't think we're in the minority or even alone, but that's where people would most of the people I've talking to, and I assume with you as well, though don't have me speak for you, Barrett, but everybody that's read this book usually say up until the first 600 to 700 pages, that part is phenomenal, and then the last 300 to 500 pages is decent but not phenomenal.
Yeah, pretty much everyone I know says the same thing.
Right.
And it's, I don't know if it's, writing about the apocalypse is way more interesting than society building, I think, is part of it. And a little bit of what happens is an anticlimactic scene, kind of.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, yeah, no, there's two things you said there that are really strong points to the second half of the book, which is what we're going to discuss before we begin discussing our thoughts about the CBS All Access miniseries. But the first part is the fall of society is definitely more interesting than the building of society. And a lot of people compare this to zombie books, because zombie books or zombie movies where the fall of society and then there's the dystopian part after. But the most exciting part, at least for me, for zombie films are always the ones where the apocalypse starts as the world begins to crumble. So in other words, like even Bird Box was another example on Netflix where society's normal and suddenly boom, something happens and everything goes to shit. And that's pretty cool. I've always loved those type of stories. But like The Walking Dead, where once we hit the part where it's just them traveling and trying to survive in this post-apocalyptic world, that really doesn't excite me as much, or is not as exciting as much, at least as for me. And then the second part that you said that I thought was pretty interesting is that it's very anticlimactic, and that's the running joke. And even if Stephen King or his family are listening to this podcast, which is doubtful, but you never know, they may. The running joke is Stephen King can write a hell of a book, but he can't write an ending for shit. And he even made a joke about that in his appearance in It Part 2, the movie, where he did a cameo. And there was a running joke about that he talks about, he even knows that there's a running joke that he can't write an ending. And
what's funny is I don't think the end of it is anticlimactic as I do The Stand.
yeah, that's fair. And to be honest, that's just a running joke, I think, because some of his books are most certainly like that. The Outsider was a phenomenal book, but the last 50 pages was anticlimactic. The Stand was that way, a few others, but he sets them that aren't like that too, which is The Dead Zone is awesome. Pet Sematary ending is pretty solid. You mentioned It. You know, so there's a lot of them that are pretty solid. Desperation's pretty solid, I felt. So I remember there was a running joke way back when I was a kid in the 80s that every Stephen King, and my mother even used to laugh about it because, you know, she used to follow Stephen King. She was a reader, and obviously being a New Englander and him being a New Englander, everybody followed him in New England. Even my mother, who wasn't a big horror fan. And the running joke in the 80s was every movie based off of his stories suck. You know, I mean, that yep. wasn't true. It wasn't true because, you know, Salem's Lot was pretty damn good. The Dead Zone was pretty damn good. But there was a lot of crappy ones, too, like Maximum Overdrive and whatever. So that was a running joke. And then
Maximum Overdrive was fun. It just wasn't really like the story.
Right. Yeah. And when I say suck, I say it loosely because, again,
yeah.
if you're just watching a nice drive-in movie, grindhouse film, or midnight movie, cult film, or whatever, Midnight Overdrive fits the bill perfectly. So who cares if it's not, you know, Citizen Kane or Lawrence of Arabia?
Right.
You know, so, but yeah. So there's the joke that King can't write an ending, which is obviously not true, but it's enough of his work has had that problem that it has become kind of part of the Stephen King legend, and he even has embraced it as well.
What's interesting about the end in this is that, and I don't want to get too far into it because we're not there yet, but that the end is anticlimactic because of the story itself. I mean, we kind of, as entertainment eaters of entertainment, we expect like big fireworks and stuff, you know, like both societies directly attacking each other or something. So that might be why it feels anticlimactic. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And to be honest, the thing I think I disliked most about the second half of the book is that the protagonists become less likable. I felt once they become politicians, I was like, I hope they all die, basically. you know, and because they admit what they're doing, that they're manipulating the people, that they're not really democratic, that they kind of lie and cheat to make sure that there's quote unquote peace, and also the villains aren't necessarily really villains because, okay, so, all right, the Walking Man may be an evil dude, as we know, but a lot of the folks necessarily in Vegas, and there's a lot of children there and all that, they aren't really that evil, you know? They, yep. They've been just shit on by people for so long, a lot of them, and a lot of them are evil, but a lot of them were just shit on, you know? There's, like, the stripper, and then there's a few other characters that
the cook
it's like
wasn't even seeming that bad. And some of them may be better than they were before the apocalypse.
Exactly. And as we know, you know, and we try to even live that way today, the enemy isn't necessarily the people. The enemy is the government, right? So mm-hmm. when we're fighting Nazi Germany or hating Soviet Russia or worrying about communist China or Islamic Iran, it's not really the people. It's their governments, right? I mean,
right.
Do we, you know, do you hate or think the people in Iran are bad? No, of course not. So it's just you know, manipulation. George Orwell wrote it all perfectly in 1984 and Animal Farm and all that. So and then even in this book here, Stephen King's book, the people aren't even really being manipulated enough because the walking dude is and this whole government is kind of like laissez-faire, and the few times when they do execute people and whatever, the problem I think is they focus way too much on Colorado and way too little on Nevada in the second half of the book, and so the evils are what we're supposed to think of the evils in Nevada that are happening aren't really in the forefront. And so I never really got to hate the people in Nevada as we're kind of supposed to think we hate. I don't know. I mean, am I way off on this?
I think that he's trying to show two things here. One is that the people aren't necessarily bad people. They are being run by this bad guy. And ultimately, right, his badness is the demise of that new place.
Explain
and
the
they
last
all
part.
They all go down with him. Well, because he's evil and his intention is to destroy the other set of survivors, that eventually is what comes back on them and kills them.
Sure. Right.
And because he's pulled some people that are not necessarily right in the head or good, he creates his own downfall, really.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. And it's kind of makes it also the second half of the book makes good and evil a little too simple, because some of the folk in Colorado feel as threatened of the people in Nevada as a lot of the regular Nevada folk feel threatened of the people in Colorado. Now, the people in Colorado may be lied to and saying, you know, you have to worry about the people. I mean, the people in Nevada may be lied to, and they're being told by the walking dude or and his minions that, you know, the people in Colorado, they're coming for us. They're coming for us. We got to stop them. And then you got the Colorado folk who are most certainly aware of the walking dude is bad because of the dreams. But again, a lot of that is because of the supernatural. And I think the supernatural part of the second half of the novel kind of, I mean, it's cool. It's a great concept and the walking dude's a great villain and all that. But if they were just, if it was more like The Walking Dead, and I'm not a fan of The Walking Dead at all, the TV series, but if it was more where you had just bad people or people misunderstood or people that are paranoid with no supernatural at all, worried about one side versus the other side, I think that would have been a more fulfilling,
a more
story.
Nuanced book for sure, because this one isn't. You have a set of people that you're being told are the good people because they're having the good dreams. And right, you have a set of bad people who are the bad people because they're having a set of dreams to go to this guy who's completely evil. And by choosing to go to him, they've basically associated themselves with evil, and we're supposed to dislike them.
Right, exactly. And I don't know if that's necessarily legit, because as we see with Glenn Bateman, especially, because I couldn't stand his character, especially in the second half of the book. The first half, I was fine with him, but he's the whole thing about how they try to shut down people. They think they're the chosen people by Mother Abigail. They also rigged the election, so they're all elected. And then also the whole idea that you got, because they're the first people to show up or the first people to meet Mother Abigail, they're suddenly more apt to be good rulers than, say, doctors, lawyers, engineers, business owners, CEOs. Because you got to figure, because at one point I think they say there's like 10 to 30,000 people in Boulder, and then we have Franny, who's like 18 or 21 or whatever age she is. And then you have Harold, who everybody thinks is brilliant, that should have made possibly the leadership role, even though he isn't. And he's only 18 or 17. He's still in high school. You know what I'm saying? You have all these people that are chosen as leaders. There's no way a 50-year-old man or woman, no matter what their heritage, race, political views, are going to vote for an 18-year-old to rule when you have, say, a CEO or a district attorney or someone else that happens to make it to Colorado. You know what I'm saying?
Well, keep in mind that most of the scientists and stuff were going over to the other society. So
yeah, well,
that.
And that's another good point, too. Yeah, but you figure, all right, you didn't have all these people. There still had to be somebody out of 30,000 people in Boulder that wasn't just a barrister, at Starbucks, you know. And then
they had a judge, so you'd think they'd have somebody of equal merit in somewhere else, you know, some other area of society, like a scientist that didn't go to the Dark Man.
Exactly. Also, too, the large group of folk who do go to the Dark Man or Nevada or whatever, Las Vegas, whatever, that do go there, and to point those people out as educated scientists, whatever, is kind of silly too. Because I mean, again, we do know that a lot of educated people, all you have to do is look at the press and the United States political system to know that there's a lot of people that are educated that don't use wisdom at all. They're just using politics and their own biases to try to rule. But I can't believe that the majority of scientists or the majority of engineers or whatnot would just suddenly be, oh, are all people who believe in science and engineering and mathematics evil?
Yeah, I don't know if it was saying that they're evil, but I think that they were drawn to the Dark Man, the Walking Dude.
Maybe it was because of the book was written, that those type of folk during the middle of the Cold War were considered bad because they're the ones that are making the bombs. I don't know. I
mean, well, remember, one of his themes back then was nuclear power and how it's bad. You get that in a lot of his books, you know, like people fighting against nuclear power. Especially like that guy in the Tommyknockers, the main character. So it's kind of like a technology versus the new world, where these people are spiritual and closer to God or something. I mean, that's the way the book feels to me.
Or the Mother Earth or something. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, I mean, I mean, again, that makes everything too simple again, because, I mean, you know, if you look at like France and almost all of Europe, 70% of their electrical power is by nuclear power, you know. So, you know, and there's no problems over there when it comes to nuclear threats, you know. So, except from the Russians, at least environmentally. Anyway, I don't. You know what I'm saying. I mean, their standard of living is A-OK, and their energy is not too bad, even if it's 70% nuclear, because it's cheap and it's.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with nuclear power. I'm definitely not on board with that. I think if it's run properly and, you know, you do the right things, it's going to run right. But sure. But I think he's just making this point in the book that there's this separation of people, and most of the people that go over to the Dark Man are the scientific people, and the people that stay with Mother Abigail are more connected to themselves in some way. I don't know if I'm explaining that well.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, Stephen King, as we know, he's a fairly progressive liberal type of folk based off of what we see on Twitter. So, and, you know, he's as guilty as anybody on Twitter, and Twitter is filled with many guilty people from all walks of life that tar and feather anybody who does not necessarily agree with their own political beliefs.
He's post also cat pictures.
Yeah. Same here. I try to get out of that crap now. And we've seen him backtrack too, where, you know, at one point, the J.K. Rowling incident, he actually kind of backed her up at one point, or at least, if not backed her up, at least defended her. And then he got ripped, and then he changed and you know, pulled everything back and said, I have no, he spinned it where he didn't necessarily rip her anymore, but he pulled all his support from her. So, he's a little wishy-washy too. And so his thinking in the real world, how he thinks in the real world, may have formed the basis of this book, which kind of makes the good and the bad a little too black and white. And yet when he defines and talks about those characters in the book, the good really aren't all that good, and the bad really aren't all that bad. And
well, I think that's his point, too. I think that is the point he's trying to make, ultimately, is that there are this group of people, yeah, they were drawn to the Dark Man, but some of them aren't so bad, and some of them are just there, and were drawn there and don't know what to do. And then there, you know, there are people that are in the other society that are leaving it because they don't get along there either. You know, they may go to the Dark Man, they may just go somewhere else, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Well, and that's another thing that was, I didn't think was explained well enough, because if I was in that era, you know, if this was real and I had to live with that, I don't think I would go to either side, because I don't want to be near those people because they all suck. So it's like, why couldn't I just, you know, pack it up and head down to, you know, some nowhere's man, Arkansas, and set up there and have my little farm and be fine. Why do I have to go to Boulder? Why do I have to go to Las Vegas?
I think the dreams were drawing them, but that doesn't call into account, what about South America? What about in Europe?
Yeah.
You know, is this playing out over there? Are people trying to get across the ocean to join the two groups, or is it just the U.S.? And that kind of seems weird to me, too, you know?
Yeah, I would love to hear perspectives of folks from other nations, because some of the other podcasts on the Dark Discussions Network that I and you're a part of, Barrett, including the Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Review podcast, we have listeners from England, from Ireland, from Finland, from Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, and various other places in the world, because podcasts are pretty much international, because it's just, you know, you can listen to it anytime, and it's all you have to do is log on to the computer. So I would love to hear other foreign nations' perspective of, like, is this book a American-centric book completely wrongly? And looking at it that way, because, yeah, you know, you have 300 million people in the U.S., and then another 120 in Mexico, and another, 30 million in Canada. You add all those people together, that's 350 million people, maybe. And then you got another 6 billion in the rest of the world. What happened to those 6 billion?
Well, they did send the disease elsewhere, so everybody else was killed. But there's still a percentage that had to live.
Pockets. Yeah, there's got to be right. If whatever amount of people, you know, let's say 30,000 in Vegas and 30,000 in Boulder, so 60,000 people survived in North America, and you assume that out of the other 6 billion people, there had to be at least 300,000, if not more. So you're right. Yes, I'm curious what other nations think. Are they kind of like insulted because this novel doesn't represent them at all, except for us going
to kill them all, sending over to kill everybody else.
Right. Yeah, the U.S. government to cover up their screw up, or it's not even the U.S. government. It was just this
military. Military. Well, it wasn't really rogue. They were supposed to do what they were doing, but it got loose and they screwed up.
Right. It's the deep state. The non-elected officials, as everybody calls in the U.S. Fucked everything up, and they then decide to send it everywhere else because, hey, why not? Let's not be blamed. It could have happened in Armenia, or it could have happened in Pakistan. It had nothing to do with us. You know, that means cover up.
And they figured everyone's going to be dead anyway, so it doesn't really matter. If we send it everywhere else, let's just make sure that nobody knows.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a curious novel. If you look at it too deeply, you may find, unfortunately, a lot of flaws or things that make you roll your eyes. But that's the problem with a lot of the stuff is that we're here to look at it as not just a story, but also what does it mean, right? And when we do that, we suddenly see these things that kind of make, at least me, make my eyes roll a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have to go into specifics or anything like that, but I know Because some of the things, man, I'll be honest, a lot of the things that I'm thinking of are all the nitpicks, unfortunately, for the second half of the book. And I apologize for anybody who loves the book as much as me and you do, Barrett. But, yeah, I mean, the second half really makes me have a lot of nitpicks. And one of them is the Harold's one. First of all, even though he is a dink, he's partly created by the people around him, right? I mean, at least this is my opinion, because Glenn Bateman, he's the one that purposely gets him off the council. First of all, he shouldn't have been on the council anyway, because he's only 18 or 17. But so, taking away all that nonsense, and we actually believe 30,000 people, especially, you know, and a lot of them are adults that are educated, would actually say, yeah, we'd be okay with a 17-year-old high school boy who hasn't got laid yet to rule my world. But let's say we can buy that, okay, even though I can't. But we'll say we can. Harold gets screwed by Bateman, because it was Bateman and Nick. Nick, too. Dick didn't like Harold.
Well, Nick really didn't want him. But let's keep in mind that he allowed it to happen, because he could have gotten on there if he wanted to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he could have fought it. You're probably right. Yeah.
And I don't think it would have taken much, because he had gotten a following at that point, because he was helping get rid of the dead bodies.
Yeah, and also, what's his name? Larry liked him, right? Because Larry was the one that followed all his messages. So even if Larry didn't know what was in the quote-unquote heart, if you want to so say, of Harold, he still liked Harold because, hey, Harold was, you know, what kept him going. You know, even though Nick was a dick, too. I didn't like his character at all in the first half. But not Nick, I'm sorry. Larry. Larry's a dick. I didn't like him at all.
He's not a real nice – well, they even say he's not a real nice guy.
yeah, right. That's the running joke about his song, right? He's not a righteous dude.
And remember, Harold is bad once – it's really his fault that he becomes bad, because he lays claim to someone that he can't lay claim to. But it's because of his age. He's immature, but he's smart. And those two things don't always go well together.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Yeah, because I know that's one thing. I mean, I was a stupid kid, you know, just like him at points where, you know, you become infatuated with a girl and she rejects you. And it's like, woe is me. And it's like, but then when I hit my 20s, I was like, you know, get rejected. It's like, oh, who cares? I just go to downtown Boston and, you know, go to a bar and I can get like 12 phone numbers that night if I really wanted to, which I did. And then, you know, you get a few dates and maybe you find someone that you like, you know, so and you're absolutely right. It's like, he's infatuated and tries to put a claim on a girl who's older than him that doesn't have any interest in him that way. And yet there's not thousands like in a pre-apocalypse world, but there's a handful of girls that he could have probably easily.
That they soon find afterwards, you know, at that one little ambush spot. So
yeah,
I mean, he could have gone the right way, but he also, I think, is a little bit controlled by the Dark Man.
Yeah,
I think their minds are somewhat controlled by the dreams they're getting in, because he's getting those dreams. It kind of moves him in the direction of doing the wrong thing, because you see at one point before his death that he realizes that he really screwed up.
Right. Yeah. Because when you really look at it, his vengeance, you know, I mean, a lot of people have vengeance. A lot of people have anger, but a lot of times that vengeance and anger, if not justified for religious or humanist reasons, at least can be understood. So, you know, if you get screwed over, you know, someone sabotages you and you get fired because they sabotage you, or if someone steals your spouse, you know, or someone, you know, hurts your kid or whatever. Vengeance is an easy, and anger are easy emotions to hook onto. And in this case, his idea of vengeance is specifically because he feels that his girl was stolen from him. And yet she was never his in the first place. So it wasn't like someone stole his wife. It's not like someone stole his job, and it's not like someone hurt his pet or kid or his mother or his father. So I guess his vengeance and his anger are wrongly placed or wrongly there, because it's related to a girl that he never had in the first place.
Yep.
He just, you know, and so he, but he considers it like, I lost, so I got to get my vengeance. And you're right, it's probably some of it's dark, man. Some of it is immaturity for sure, because he's, again, we're only talking about a kid that's 16 or 17. I think he may even be 16 in the book, to be honest, not even 17.
Yeah, I think so, he's 16.
Yeah, so we're only talking about someone that can't vote, can't join the military, hasn't been laid yet, can't drive a car legally. You know, so we're not talking about – oh, and of course his home life was pretty crappy because his mother was a bitch.
And
so,
he's covered in acne, so he's not necessarily the most attractive person either.
Right, he's a little overweight, you know, and all that. But, you know, by the time he's dead, the acne and the overweight part of him have gone, and he's become a fairly well-rounded, good-looking dude. You know, not, he's no Brad Pitt, but he's not the kid that he was in high school either. So, yeah, it's you know what? It's also partly he's probably has behavioral health issues.
Yeah, I think so. Well, and he's manipulated also by a woman.
Right. Well, let's talk about
the dude uses Nadine to give him almost sex.
Right. Well, just not. I mean, he has anal and all that stuff, but he doesn't have vaginal sex, right?
That's right. Right. Yeah. That's the one thing they can't do.
Right. Right. Well, and that's let's talk about Nadine. Nadine's another curious character too, because she is a 38 or something year old woman by the time the book starts. But she's really good looking. But she was marked even as a college girl by the walking dude as his. And I still don't get any of that. You know, why was she marked? You know, I mean, again, you know, the exorcist, you know, why was Regan, taken over by the demon? We don't know. But we don't really know anything about Nadine either, why she was marked, because we have the flashbacks of the seance and all that crap when she was in the sorority or whatever. But there's nothing in her history. Actually, there's nothing in her at all that represents evil until she decides to manipulate Harold.
Yeah, and she even at one point gives herself an out, but it's too late because she goes to Larry and says, I'll have you now. I'll be with you. And it's too late because he's moved on. And she knows that. She knows it's too late, so it's not really an out. But she, you know that she doesn't necessarily want to go to the walking dude.
Right, and that's
She's just compelled.
That's an interesting thing too, because she was strong enough to spurn the walking dude by going back to Larry and saying, hey, Larry, I'll be your woman now. And he has to say, I'm sorry, I can't because I'm already with someone else. Actually, he's more rude than that, to be honest. But, but the thing is if she was willing to spurn the walking, or strong enough, I should say, spurn the walking dude and contact Larry, why, similar to Harold, couldn't she just say, you know what, I can't have Larry, and now, and she's a 40-year-old woman or 38-year-old woman, 39 by the time that this is, that so she's not a dumb kid. She could have said, you know what, there's thousands of people now, there's 15,000 men here, probably most of them are single because all their spouses are dead if they were married. And if they weren't married, they don't have a girlfriend anyway. I mean, a boyfriend anyway. Actually, let me rephrase that. A girlfriend anyway. So she could have had her pick and choose of anybody in Boulder, right? So mm-hmm. why was she able to be strong enough to spurn the walking dude to throw herself at Larry? And Larry, honestly, at this point, is no big catch, because it's, you know, who cares if you wrote a hit song? Because at this point, you know, if you don't have, you know, there's no such thing as fame anymore, so who cares? And plus, he was a dirtbag anyway. Why couldn't she just say, you know what, I'm going to look around and see if there's any good eligible bachelors around here?
I think that the consequences of not going to the walking dude would have been too great. Yes, she, I don't know that I'd say she spurned him. She just had this one opportunity where she may have been able to escape, but she in the end isn't able to.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe right. Maybe it was just whatever weird love she had for Larry. It was strong enough to fight the walking dude, but when she was spurned, she became a defeatist, or she just didn't have any other quote unquote love power to escape the walking dude. And you know what's funny about a lot of these characters, and again, this is how it is in real life too, and I've said this to a number of people, which is a lot of it is just arbitrary. In other words, if she, you know, she met Larry, you know, randomly on the road, and she spends time with Larry, and then she just decides that Larry is attractive and I like him or whatever, but it's just because he's there. It's not because of Larry, because if it was because of Larry, no one would want anything to do with Larry as a human being, because he was a scumbag.
At least in the beginning. He becomes a better person by the end, but yeah, in the beginning, he's not necessarily one you want to be around. He's hard as nails.
Right, right. The only attraction he had was that prior to the apocalypse was that he may have some wealth. He's a decent looking guy, and he may have some wealth and fame because of his song. So as a result, just how the world is, a certain percentage of women would find him attractive because of that. Now with the apocalypse gone, and she doesn't even know that he's the Larry Underwood that sang the song, because the song became famous, was his first hit, and it was right before the apocalypse, so he wasn't a household name yet, and people didn't know what he looked like. They just heard the song on the radio. It's not like she knew that this was the Larry, and he never told her that. So this problem with this is that she just liked him because she happened to be with him. So,
well, I think it's partly that, and I also think partly he has some charisma. That is likable, and you don't see that hard part of him until everything comes down. If it came down to you and him, you're screwed.
Yeah.
And I say that with his friends too. I think he would, you know, he's going to think of himself first at this point in the book, at that point in the book, rather than you.
Yeah. Well, and that's true. There's a lot of talented folk, and is there just a lot of people in general that have a cult of personality around them, even if they are worthless as human beings. And so, you know, we just, by the time people hear this, we've already wrapped up the show, but we were doing a podcast called The Undoing, a therapy session podcast, which is based off the HBO television series The Undoing, starring Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant. And there's a scene in that where Hugh Grant's character, his lawyer, says, "Ooh, you have something in you that people like. You have a charisma, and we're going to use that when we go to court. We're going to we're going to get people to like you because of your charisma. We're going to use your charisma on TV when you do the interview to get people to feel pity for you." And so certain people have that, and Larry sure has that. But similar to the character in The Undoing, Larry's a scumbag just like that guy. So it shows that people can become the center of attention, and others can circle around that person, even if that person may have in their heart crapola.
Yep.
Now the question is why did Larry get out of it and become quote unquote good, while someone like Harold doesn't get out of it and he becomes bad? And I don't know. I mean, a lot, that's the thing about the Carol character, is that he's unfortunately very cliche, because a lot of bad people were abused or felt worthless when they were younger, and they become criminals when they get older. You know, because everybody says, oh, it's going to be that the jock that beat up everybody in high school is going to be the bad guy when they get older. And yet, oddly, they're the ones that usually become the most successful, because I guess they're more well-adjusted and more, I guess, happy, maybe. I don't know. And then you have the person that was picked on. You would think, oh, they're going to be the one that's going to be the good person when they get older, because they see the badness in the world, and they'll become smart and you know, try to change the world. But a lot of times they become the angry people and become the bad people when they become adults. And so I felt that was too cliche, and that is generally true in a lot of cases. However, the Harold character, I think, fell into that trap way too easily.
Yeah.
Let's see. So we've been talking about 48 minutes. Again, we don't have to go into full details about the book anymore. You know, we can just talk about general stuff as we're doing now. Let's talk a little bit about the trash can. I mean, here's another example of a character I felt he's an awesome character, and yeah, and the kid was too. But specifically, we talked about the trash can man. And you mentioned it earlier. You said a lot of some of the people that were used by the walking dude were people that were I forget the term you used. I wish I wrote it down when we were earlier in the podcast, but I'll try to word it out. Damaged or
yeah,
disenfranchised or something. And yeah, and this guy here really is. I mean, he does a lot of bad things, but is he evil? Or are you just being used? I mean, because you got to remember, he's obviously a low IQ person. Yeah,
he's sick. I kind of picture him like Donald Sutherland in Backdraft.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. Right when you said Donald Sutherland, I said he's talking about Backdraft. Yeah, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, he's something wrong in the head. He was abused by family and neighbors and his mother, and obviously he had
all growing up, I think he's abused, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, people were, you know, so he's where he is because of most likely IQ more than anything else, as well as being probably IQ, because a lot of things that happened to him as he grew up as a kid and as an adult are because of his low IQ. Right,
yeah,
behavioral health,
yeah,
issues, whatever they are. And when I say low IQ, I don't mean to insult anybody, but when you have a certain IQ, you're automatically considered a behavioral health person if it's lower than a certain percentage, a certain number. So I think anything below 90 or 85 or something like that is considered a behavioral health issue. So even IQ wise, you can be considered a behavioral health issue, even if you're not diagnosed with schizophrenia or sociopathy or any various other OCD, you know, anything like that. You can just have a certain type of IQ and also be lumped in with the behavioral health HIPAA numbers, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know if he's really evil. I don't consider
him evil, and actually he's probably he does the good act in the book.
Yes.
He takes care of the problem.
Yes. Yes, he does. Yeah.
So I feel like he is actually a tool of, I don't even know that I'd call it the good side, but the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you this. When he sabotages, why does he sabotage the airplane hangar again in Vegas? There was something where he
does
something.
They treated him badly at some point, and so he got upset, and then he put all the bombs throughout. Plus, he wants to see everything explode and burn.
Right.
So yeah, when they treat him badly, it brings back something to him, and so he decides to do that. And I think there is a malicious part of him that did that. I don't know that he necessarily connects with that malicious side. I think he thinks of it as, I want to see everything burn.
Right.
But yeah, I think that's why he did it. He was treated badly.
Right. Also, I could see someone with that behavioral health issue of the low IQ not understanding that malicious activities may be considered bad.
Or connecting what's going to happen to killing people.
Right. That's true, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's a fair point.
Because he even damages himself when he starts some of his fires.
Yes, he does.
He puts himself in peril because he doesn't care about the consequences to anything except for the fire getting bigger.
Right. Right. That's true. Yeah. And one of his crimes as a youngster was burning down a church, right? And,
yeah.
And again, though, he didn't do it because he hates religious people or he's bigoted against a certain faith. Or he just likes burning things.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, that has to do with his behavioral health issues. So he was really being used by the walking dude rather than anything more. And even let's talk about Lloyd, because Lloyd was a dirtbag. He's another guy with a low IQ.
He's not a great guy, yeah. But once he gains some intelligence,
yeah,
he actually starts to have more of a conscience.
Right. And that's another thing that's interesting, because obviously he gets that gem or whatever it is that makes him become more intelligent. And with intelligence, he understands responsibility. He understands chaos versus law and various other things. And he even understands good versus bad. And he also understands honor. And he also understands loyalty.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the problem with his character is he unfortunately follows these things for the walking dude, because if it wasn't for the walking dude, he not only wouldn't have any of these things that could make him the better person that it appears that he has become when he does gain intelligence, but it also is for the fact that if it wasn't for the walking dude, he'd be dead.
Yeah,
in a jail cell.
Yep.
So that's an interesting thing that you brought that up about the intelligence, because prior to that, he is a really, really bad guy. And then, oddly, when he gains power and intelligence, he's still considered evil. And part of whatever the walking dude's doing, and yet he doesn't feel as like a bad guy anymore. It's kind of odd.
And he becomes more of a weak point for the walking dude.
Yeah.
Like a point of failure. Now, I think he does everything he's supposed to and everything, but he starts questioning things. And I think that comes out in the other characters around him see that.
Yeah. 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 Because he's the one that kind of, if not throw a shot at the walking dude, he always shows disappointment. Like he says, yeah, it's just not looking good. You know, it's just not looking good. You know, because he doesn't really actually say the walking dude's a bad guy or screwed up or whatever. But well, he says screwed up, but he says it in a way with that's disappointing rather than anger. And the people around him who aren't necessarily as loyal to the walking dude because they just came to Nevada because of the dreams versus Lloyd, who became because the walking dude actually saved his life. They become very much disenfranchised, like the cook and whatnot. While Lloyd, because his origin with the walking dude is a lot different than the rest of the people in Vegas, his downfall is kind of more tragic because of that, I feel.
And he's more loyal to him because of that as well. Now, it's interesting because you really see the difference in him then, as opposed to when he meets with his lawyer and gets put into prison, and he's like, I'm going to get off, right? I'm gonna be okay, right? And the
lawyer was awesome.
Yeah, the lawyer was great. But you see that he didn't understand consequences.
Right. And that's part of the low IQ. And yeah. Also, probably a little bit sociopath, too. But I think it's more low IQ than sociopath. Because I don't think his misunderstanding has to do with no conscience. I think his misunderstanding is he doesn't understand right and wrong, the intellectual theory reason, not because he has no conscience.
Right.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Yeah, because he's – and then the lawyer just says, you got to lie, dude. Just cause well, he doesn't even say that. He just makes up a story, and lawyer goes, no, that didn't what happened. He goes, no, yeah. And then the lawyer would say, no, it happened like this, right? And then he slowly gets it. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what I'll say. And so he's really stupid. He's a really stupid guy. And
well, he gets led around. Like, he gets led around by the poker eyes guy.
Yeah, the hoop, or whatever he does. Yeah, that guy. So he gets led around by that guy, and then he gets led around by the walking dude. But even then, like we said, even though he's wicked intelligent now, it doesn't matter because, yeah, he's already, his life is really because of the walking dude. But you know what's weird about that whole thing is that trash can man, he gets one of those stones too, but his behavioral health IQ doesn't change.
No, it doesn't. And maybe it does something different for him because he starts just almost unerringly finding all the old weapons and stuff, right?
Yes. Yeah, right. So he does it. It's interesting too. The walking dude, it's a strange guy because the walking dude lets his lieutenants run everything pretty much laissez-faire. That's how you say it, right? Laissez-faire? Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. And so his lieutenants are anybody with the stone. And so that includes Lloyd. It includes the trash can man. And there's a couple others. Like there's the mafia dude and the business guy there. And there's a couple others. I don't know if they have the stones. But either way, there's a handful of people that have some power in Vegas, and a couple of them have the stones, and the trash can man goes off to do what he's got to do, which is to find as many weapons in the desert at military locations left over from the federal government after the collapse of society, and he does a good job pretty well. It's just that he's mentally insane.
Yeah.
And his IQ hasn't changed, even with the gemstone.
Right. Well, it's interesting, too, when you compare the two societies, I find it funny that both try to regulate drugs and alcohol. So in the Walking Dudes area, they just crucify you.
Yeah.
And in the other one, they're trying to gather up all the alcohol because they have that one guy who's an alcoholic and, starts causing a little mayhem. So I just find that interesting, too, how both societies come down to that in some way.
Right. And that's another reason why, when I said earlier, I don't want to be with any of these two cities.
They're all trying to control you.
Yeah, fuck them. I'd burn them down, too. I don't have nothing to do with those societies. They're stupid.
Yeah.
But you're right. Because it's trivial stupidity. It's not like real important things. It's just the nitpicky trying to control how people do things and think, and it's just stupid, and that's the thing why I couldn't stand Boulder is because you see, unlike Vegas, you really get the inner workings of Boulder because the second half of the book, even though there's two sides, they really focus about 70% on the Boulder side. And everything they do just pisses me off. And then when that guy that keeps on complaining at all the meetings, mm-hmm. and eventually one day he disappears.
Yeah,
because he probably head to Las Vegas. But to be honest, if I was that guy too, and they're not letting me speak, I would be pissed too, and I would want to leave. So whether he went to Vegas or that small farm in Arkansas, like I mentioned, I can't blame him. because I wouldn't want to be there.
Nope.
You know, so because everything he said, I mean, it's annoying because it's obviously against the leadership. But if you, I mean, that's what, you know, that's it reminds me too much of today, where you got everybody piling on anybody who disagrees with you. And it's like, no, it's just an opinion, dude. Can I speak? Yeah, you know, that's why social media is a shithole, a cesspool, and politics is a cesspool, and all that shit is a cesspool. And I felt the book kind of fell into that trap, because I, even though the guy was annoying, I actually empathized with the guy that was complaining at the meeting more than my main characters that I'm supposed to like. So I don't know.
Well, what's interesting also is that both are religious societies at this point.
Yeah, I felt that's an interesting thing about the novel is, and Stephen King is kind of, I have no idea what his religious faith is. I know his daughter is married to some clergy woman. But I don't know about him personally or him immediately, but in most of his other books, there's no real religion. I mean, obviously you have a little religion in Salem's Lot, but that's more because it's vampires rather than because it's a religious book.
Yeah. But, the religion is not really a big theme as far as like it's a small theme. You'll have like the priest from Salem's Lot and he shows up in his Gunslinger series and stuff. But generally, I wouldn't say that you have a Christian-based faith idea in his books.
Yeah, most of his evil is outer being stuff. You know, he because he even, you know, throws allusions to what do you call it, Lovecraft and stuff, right? I mean, what was it? I think was it Needful Things? That there's a guy that goes to there's a character where there's Shoggoth or whatever is on the wall at graffiti and stuff in one of his books, and I thought it was Needful Things. It could be Tommy Markers.
Might be.
It's one of those.
Needful Things, isn't that more a little more religious, because isn't the guy supposed to be kind of the devil?
Devil or something. Yeah. But you know, like Pet Sematary is the Wendigo, and then you got The Dead Zone, which is, there is nothing about faith in that. And then there's, I'm just trying to think of some of his other books. Oh, what was that called? Desperation is more like outer beings. Tommy,
yeah. Alien. It is definitely outer being.
Yeah, it's an outer being. So, yeah, so there's really not much religious stuff. So it was kind of interesting to see him go kind of sort of the religious way, even though it's never defined that the good side is, I guess, the Judeo-Christian Islam God, and the Walking Man isn't really the devil or a spawn of hell. It's just, I don't, you know.
I kind of picture him like the devil, but yeah, it's not like a direct relation. It would be like an image of it, you know what I mean? It wouldn't be a direct, you wouldn't directly call him Satan, but he's like Satan. And like Mother Abigail believes the Christian stuff, but the whole spiritual side is more faith-based. You don't really, you don't get this idea that necessarily,
right,
what kind of God it is, I guess.
Sure. Yeah.
It's the God of the Bible, but it's more nebulous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you could, it's nebulous, and you could put the Bible, if the story or the nebulous part that we're talking about is like a piece of paper on a desk, and then you have these see-through plastic things that you can put on top of the paper, the Bible would be one of those plastic things, so you could put it on top and it kind of fits. But if you take it off and replace it with some sort of other religion or agnostics and put it on top, or even alien kooks and you put it on top, they kind of all fit on top of it.
Yeah.
If you know, so it's like the nebulous is so nebulous that if you're Christian, you could look at it as Christian. But if you're, you know, some tribe in the middle of the Amazon jungle in Brazil that doesn't even know what Muhammad or Jesus Christ or Moses is, you could look at it as this is an evil entity or this is a religious, a good entity based off of their faith. So yeah. It's that's what I mean. Like, so I don't know. It's a strange thing. And we never learn enough to know who, at least, I mean, I haven't read the Gunslinger book, so I don't know too much about the Walking Dude. And I'm not really interested in the greater universe that King's built. I don't like books that are like that. I'm really more a fan of just individual books and the story in the one book. That's just how I am, because I've had read enough books that, you know, like when I was a kid, I read the Hardy Boys, and you knew the Hardy Boys were never in danger. So it's like, I get the next book, it's like, okay, I already know who's going to survive. You know, so I try to look at everything as an individual book without this universe crap. And so if I look at this book as a standalone without the universe crap, the Walking Dude, you never really know what he is, who he is, and why he is. And you never know why Mother Abigail or Nadine or whatever have been called, you know, because when you really think about it, those are the three characters that have a greater calling from outer dimensions. Mm-hmm. Unlike everybody else.
Well, I'll tell you, the greater universe does not, of his books, don't really tell you any more about the Walking Dude. I mean, it doesn't really, it would not answer your questions.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
You might know more about him, but you won't know really more about what we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. And the same thing with Mother Abigail and as I mentioned earlier about Nadine, why was Nadine chosen? What, you know, what was in her?
What made her special? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you just don't know. And, you know, that's fine because, again, if we're that, I mean, that's an interesting thing in today's day and age, because a lot of novels and movies nowadays are more like that, where you're in the perspective of the characters in the book or the movie, so you learn no more than they do. While in the past, a lot of books and movies, you learn more than the characters in the book, so you know that, okay, this, you know, because you have the preambles, or they explain that, you know, some being came from there and they did this and they did that, and that's the setup, you know. But nowadays, a lot of stuff doesn't do that, I've noticed, and this book kind of does that, where they don't give you that much, similar to a lot of modern stuff, where you know no more than the character's perspective in the book.
Yeah, and Mother Abigail doesn't really, she knows she has faith, but she doesn't really know anything right beyond that.
Yeah, the only thing she knows is that she's still alive at the age she is because, similar to Nadine, she knew she was chosen for something that was going to happen in the future. And yeah, and that future, at least for Abigail, unlike Nadine, was going to be many years further into her life than she would expect had she not been chosen. If she had not been chosen, she probably would have croaked, you know, like any other person at a normal age for an elderly person. But because she was chosen for some reason, and she knew she was chosen for some reason, her life went on and above maybe 30 or 40 years longer than she would have otherwise had if she hadn't been chosen.
Well, and I kind of picture her as like the Moses character, if you were, yeah, making a comparison to the Bible.
Yeah, yeah, that's a fair point. And I kind of like that analogy, even though the Moses analogy, obviously one difference is that Moses actually spoke with God,
yeah,
and understood exactly what he was supposed to do, while Mother Abigail was still kind of in the dark all the way until her death, when you think about it.
Well, and she kind of made it to the promised land too.
Yeah, she did. You're right.
Unless
yeah.
you consider the Promised Land after the events of the book, you know, where everything
yeah,
is
yeah.
concluded.
Right, right. Yeah, because the Promised Land, that's the funny thing is that the boulder becomes, when Stu and Franny leave Boulder at the end, they're complaining about how it's become more like the prior world and I'm thinking it was already like you guys caused it.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, I thought it was worse because I thought their government was worse than the government that they had left behind before the apocalypse, because back then you could have booze and you could have cigarettes and you could do what you wanted in the United States at that point. And then when they took over, like you said, they were doing all these stupid things. It was just fuck you. And then they suddenly say, yeah, you know what? It sucks here. Let's leave. And it's like,
after they did all the damage, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Go, right. Let's exactly. move on.
Yeah, exactly. So fuck them. Hopefully they get eaten by bears or something in Nebraska on the way back to Maine. Hell with those people.
So let's move on to kind of the finale, which is the big part of what's left. I mean, we've pretty much discussed both societies and their differences and how they're alike in some ways.
That's the most interesting part about the second half of the book, in my opinion, you know, because I don't really care about the characters' stories that much because I didn't like many of them by that point in the book. But anyway, continue.
So they, well, we, you know, we get to the point where Harold tries to kill them all.
Yep.
And Nick is killed.
Yep.
And Mother Abigail has gone out at this time to the desert. And she just shows back up.
Yeah, actually, I don't even know what the desert. It was the mountains or something, I think.
Yeah, wherever it was. She goes out into nature basically naked and comes back at the same time as the council gets blown up.
Right.
Nadine leaves with Harold because she has to get to the walking dude. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that Nadine, similar to Trash Can Man, have dead weight with them because both the kid with the Trash Can Man and Harold with Nadine think they're smarter or more powerful or whatever than the leader they're going to. And so the walking dude decides to kill both of them because he feels that they're a threat to his power because they're not going to fall in line like he would hope.
Right. And Harold served his purpose. He created the bomb.
Yeah, exactly. So Harold's purpose, creating a bomb, and then he had too much pride, and the walking dude didn't like it. So, you know what? You did your purpose. I'll just kill you because you're going to just be a problem when you get to Vegas. And same with the kid. The kid was the same way. The kid was...
Yeah, they died exactly the same way.
Yeah, had too much pride and felt that when he got there, he was going to be able to take over. And to be honest, both Harold and the kid at this point in their lives were becoming that charismatic cult of personality anyway. And if they made it to Vegas, they probably could have had a little group of people that would say, yeah, you're right, this walking dude is a fucking bozo, because he was a bozo, you know, and even Lloyd saw it. So get rid of him before they get to Vegas.
Right.
And that's why I think the walking dude took him out. So anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
So we get to this point where they decide to send emissaries. Well, let's go back a step. So they had sent spies over.
Right.
To spy on the walking dude's people.
Right.
And get information back. And they're supposed, and Tom Cullen is one of them.
Right.
And they hypnotize him so he'll eventually come back. So, but meanwhile, this bomb goes off. Nick is killed. And they decide that they're going to send emissaries to the city now because Abigail tells them that's what they need to do.
Right.
So who all goes? It's
the council.
Glenn.
Oh, the male members of the council.
Yeah, the male members of the council. So it's Glenn, it's
Nick,
Stu.
I keep on saying Nick. I meant Larry.
Yeah, Stu, Larry, and then I can't think of the fourth guy.
Bateman.
No, that's Glenn.
Glenn. Stu. Larry. The truck driver.
Yeah, he kind of stands in the background for me because his character's that way.
Yeah, he's the only one of the people that had the big dreams from Mother Abigail that we don't have a perspective of following throughout the book.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of weird.
It is weird when you think about it that he's the one character we don't get much info on.
Right, exactly. Because all his stories are similar to Nick and the rest, where he was one of the chosen by Abigail, but for whatever reason, King decided to not write his adventure, you know, and makes him really a secondary character.
Yeah.
And I can't even remember the guy's name. Yeah. What the hell is his name? Ray Brentner. That's it.
Yeah. Brentner. Yeah. Ralph Brentner.
They change. I'm thinking they're changing it. It looks like they're changing it to a woman in the miniseries.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, a Native American woman, Irene Bedard, is playing the character. Interesting. Anyway,
well, I guess it doesn't really matter. But
yeah. I mean, you know.
They go to Vegas, and this has got to be probably my most This is why the second half is so disappointing for me, because everything that they do is useless. They send spies, but the spies don't make it back in time.
Right.
They go, and nothing
all the spies die, except for Cullen.
Yeah, except for Cullen. And he doesn't make it back in time, but I guess he makes it back in time to help save Stu. But they go out there, and nothing they really do changes anything. They're just sacrifices.
Yeah.
And I guess there had to be a sacrifice on both sides for this to end. I don't know. That's dissatisfying for him, you know?
Yeah, because it's this huge journey. First of all, the whole thing is bizarre because they say, Mother Abigail says you have to walk. And it's like, why? What's the whether you bike, drive, walk, helicopter over, how does that change you as a human being? Yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's just some of these weird spiritual things that make no sense. I mean, it's like, you know, don't eat fish on Thursdays when the moon is bright or you'll go to hell type of stuff. It's like means that if I do any of that, I'm not going to go to hell because of that. I'm going to go to hell because I'm an evil person, not because of what I ate. So none of these things make, you know, and no disrespect for anybody who has religious beliefs that related to food, but if anything's going to happen, the spiritual. I don't. I just didn't understand why they had to walk.
Yeah,
it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, and Stu is left behind because he break his leg? I know
he breaks
hurts
his, leg.
Yeah, he breaks his leg, falling down that embankment, and
yeah, it was kind of weird because I still don't understand that whole scene, and not because of what happened to Stu, but because why did the sinkhole happen? Because again, we're talking about there was no natural disasters,
right?
Right. So it was just a virus. So why would a sinkhole suddenly occur in the middle of the that remote highway between Utah and Colorado?
And couldn't they have gone around it instead?
Eventually, they probably could have. Yeah, I mean, they made it sound like the sinkhole was like a long straight cavern that ran for miles.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like.
but either way, it didn't make any sense because I know there's supernatural occurring with the walking dude and the dreams and all that crap, but there was no earthquakes or tornadoes. I mean, there was a tornado with Nick and Cullen, but it was just a normal tornado. It wasn't like supernatural. So why would suddenly there be this huge sinkhole in the middle of Utah?
Well, one thing they did make that tornado seem kind of supernatural, like the walking dude sent it.
Yeah, maybe.
They made it seem malevolent.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe the walking dude had the power to make the sinkhole or something, but it wasn't but it wasn't implied as much as, say, the tornado was implied. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They don't imply that at all, the sinkhole. And it's almost like fate, like he was supposed to break his leg there. That's what I felt like it was signifying, you know?
Right, because he was supposed to survive, while the rest, it didn't matter.
Right. So that part just is dissatisfying me, and why I don't like the second half as much as the first half. I could have, you know, accepted some of it, but together those two things just bother me so much that I don't enjoy the ending as much. It's why it's not number one on my list, and it is.
Now, what's the two things again specifically? The actually, you know, if you labeled them one and two, or A and B, what are they?
Yeah, so the first one is that they sent all these spies who then are killed, the one who does get back doesn't get back in time to do anything, and they send all these emissaries after they've sent all these spies, and the emissaries don't really make a difference. They're just human sacrifices.
Right. And also, the death of the walking man, and actually the entire city of Las Vegas, occurs out of nowhere. I mean, it has nothing to do with the people in Boulder, really, to my knowledge.
Right.
It's like the hand of God or whatever they call it. But it was, I don't know, it was just weird.
So them being there at that time was ordained. Yep. And because they were there, the walking dude was showing his power, which caused the nuclear weapon that was brought to go off.
Right. But it was supernatural entity that caused it that wasn't the walking dude, even in the book, not just that TV miniseries from 1990s.
Yeah.
Right. And also, I didn't feel it was a good ending either, because I didn't hate the people in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I hate the walking dude. I mean, actually I kind of like the character. He's a pretty rocking villain. But if I'm looking at it objectively as, you know, who are they, bad people or not, besides a handful of the characters, I didn't hate any of the people in Vegas as evil or bad or people I wish dead. So when they all die, it was like, that kind of stupid and sucked, at least for me, you know? I was like,
it's very dissatisfying. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and again, I don't mean any disrespect for anybody who loves the book, because I love the book just like you, Barrett, and probably everybody who's listening to this podcast. But I mean, I'm just trying to be how I looked at it objectively. I'm not going to just be, you know, the suck up that says, oh, the book. You're insulting the book. You suck. You know, I'm not like that. I'm trying to, honestly, I'm giving my honest opinions that even though I love the book, I still had some problems with it. And I don't think they're unfair.
No, I don't think they're unfair at all. I mean, I definitely have problems with it. And I love this book. It's probably number two of my Stephen King books favorites, but it's not number one for a reason.
sure. Yeah, I mean, I have a bunch more that I like better than this book, even though I love this book too. It put it this way, I have, you know, if you have the two, I'm different than you. I have like tiers. There's the bottom tier and the top tier, and I would put this in the top tier for sure. And at the top tier, I don't have it as high as you do, because I have like Salem's Lot and Pet Sematary and Desperation and The Shining and The Dead Zone. And, you know, and I can name a few others that I liked. Oh, the Outlander or Outsider or whatever it's called. I have all those books I like way better than this book. But this book I still love almost as much, even though I just said way better. Let me rephrase. I like a little better than The Stand. But I still have The Stand up there with all those books for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I put it up pretty high. It's just, for me, it is number one for me, and then the rest kind of even out for me.
Right. And I'm a little different to you. I didn't like the book It at all.
A lot of people don't. I'm strange that way.
And you know, I tried to reread it after the first movie, and I couldn't. I stopped after like 60 pages. I got, you know what? Everything that I didn't like about it the first time, I don't like about it now. but again, I don't hate it either, and I loved the It miniseries from TV, and I loved the first movie of the new reboot. So. It's just, for whatever reason, the book just didn't work for me, and you know that doesn't mean it's a bad book. Let's see, so the whole thing, you know, that was a weird ending, and then Stu makes it back for Colin, and then Stu and Colin, I mean, Fran and Stu decide to leave and head back to. Ogunquit, Maine, which is very close to where I live. And
that seems like a lot of work and dangerous. Not that I would want to be part of that society, but I think of the amount of work they put in getting there.
Yeah.
And they head all the way back.
and to be honest, at this point, you know, there is no world, so you can go anywhere. I think I would probably go further south, even though I'm from New England and I live in New Hampshire and I grew up in Massachusetts, and every year prior to COVID I go to Ogunquit and York and all those towns in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, you know, all the time, almost weekly during the summer. That's the point. It's the summer. There is no power anymore,
so you have to cut wood if you want to have.
Right. And what about food? You know,
right, yeah, food too. You got to get food. You're going to have to hunt.
Right. So I would think it would be more apt to be smart to say go to like Jacksonville, Florida, or Charleston, South Carolina or something, you know.
Virginia wouldn't be that bad, but
yeah, Maine? I mean, Virginia, I don't think I would be doing that. I would be heading south, and don't get me wrong, Maine has a hell of a good fishing community right off of the thing, but I'm not a big fish fan, so I don't know if I could survive eating fish for all winter, you know.
Or all your life, because that's the easiest thing to get, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I'm heading down to Mobile, Alabama or something or whatever. Yeah, I don't think I'd be hanging out in Maine. Yeah.
Well, at this point, in the book, there's probably a lot of canned food that they could get, you know, and eat out of, but still.
Actually, you have a fair point there. You're absolutely right. Yep. Yeah, you're right. I don't think they have to hunt because there's going to be as much. All you have to do is go to any house in Ogunquit and you're going to find canned food. So that's a fair point.
But the warmth part, that's the part that would bother me, because you would have to be cutting a lot of wood for the winter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And they have a new baby, so, you know, it's not like you can't just, you know, not have a good environment.
That's right. Yeah. And if people don't understand, living up here, I have a pellet stove, but a few of my neighbors...
Oh, I love pellet stoves. Those are the best.
They are the best, but you can't use them with no power. So if you're going to use a fireplace, you know, and you cut the wood, people don't understand. The wood... It's not like you go out into the forest and cut trees down.
No, exactly.
What it is, someone, you pay the local hardware store, and they drop off a bunch of wood, and they throw it in your driveway, and then you cut it and stack it in your driveway. So it's not – that's not going to happen now. So it's not like you can call the hardware store and say, hey, I need, you know, a bunch of cords of wood, you know.
Yeah, and green wood doesn't really work for burning.
That's right. And Ogunquit, you know, don't get me wrong, it's not a city, but it is become suburban enough that the trees are thinned a little bit. You know, it's not like that easy to. I mean, that's not true. I mean, there's plenty of trees, but you know what I'm saying. It's not like you can just walk out the backyard. And, like Franny's house doesn't have a forest near her at all.
Right.
And that's where I assume they're going to live. You know, she's right on. The middle of the suburbs, so yeah, it's not like he's going to be able to walk out his back door and cut a tree down and get the wood. So yeah. Anyway, we're nitpicking now. This is just, you know, being funny.
Yeah.
but yeah. Anything else you want to talk about the book before we get into the CBS miniseries?
I don't think so. I think we've covered pretty much everything in, you know, my major nitpicks, and but it is a book I love. I like most everything by Stephen King. I highly recommend it. If you have never read it, read it once.
But make sure you read the extended version.
Yeah, the extended version, definitely.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. I did forget to bring up one thing, and I've kind of alluded to it every so often through my Dark Discussions podcast stuff, whenever we talk about Stephen King on that podcast. The spiritual black person. That's what Mother Abigail is, and that's kind of a they're saying it nowadays, and there's a point to it, is kind of a racist type of thing. What's your feeling on this?
I don't know. It's really hard for me to comment on that, being white male. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how others would feel about it. It didn't bother me. Her character is good, but I don't have enough experience to really say whether it's accurate or not.
Right. So, you know, just to bring it up, because it is the elephant in the room, and Stephen King has been targeted a couple of times by folks of color, and even very progressive white folk who are even probably more progressive than his extreme progressivism. It's the and this is their term, the term that is used on Wikipedia. It's not my term, but it's called magical Negro. And this is what it says: in the cinema of the United States, so this is specific to the U.S., I guess, the magical Negro is a supporting stock character who comes to the aid of white protagonists in a film. Magical Negro characters who often possess special insight or mystical powers have long been a tradition in American fiction. Now, the term magical Negro was popularized in 2001 by film director Spike Lee while discussing films with students during a tour of college campuses, in which he said, oh, and this is a good one because he brings up another Stephen King one. He doesn't even mention The Stand. He and I was thinking of this too, in which he said he was dismayed at Hollywood's decision to continue to employ this premise. Even though it's more than Hollywood, because these are books, so it's even more ingrained than just movies. He noted that the films The Green Mile, which is Stephen King, and The Legend of Bagger Vance, which is a one I have not seen, but I know it stars Matt Damon, used the super duper magical Negro. Again, this is Spike Lee speaking, not me. Critics use the word Negro because it is considered archaic and usually offensive. In modern English, this underlines their message that a magical black character who goes around selflessly helping white people is a throwback to stereotypes such as the Sambo or noble savage. Now, that's the end of the Wikipedia that I'm going to read. But I want to state that Spike Lee himself has been criticized as over-the-top, eccentric, and even I guess reverse racist himself. So that's not that's not my opinion. I just want to hold it. I'm going to finish.
Yeah. Here's my opinion on this subject.
Okay.
Sure. I am of two minds of this. I understand how it can be offensive to some people, but I also understand that people write and come up with ideas their own way. And that's just how Stephen King came up with his idea for The Green Mile. Is it a racist idea because he included someone of color in that they have powers? Like, I love The Green Mile. I think it's one of the best Stephen King adaptations ever. But that's why I have a hard time with the subject, because I understand how some people could be, you know, offended by it. But I also have to say that people have ideas. They're writing a book. You write a book and come up with your ideas, and they can be out there, you know?
Well, here's a good analogy. And this is one that always comes up with a few people I'm friendly with on Facebook, and I never comment on it because it's just not worth getting into these fights. But the term that when a person says smile to a woman, they are either, if a man says it, they're misogynistic. And if a woman says it to another woman, they're programmed into the patriarchal society. Now, yeah. And I saw this just a couple of days ago with one of someone I'm friends with on Facebook, a woman, and I was like, what? And she mentioned it about 6 months ago again too, and I was like, what? So after that, I almost commented, but I said, you know what? I'm going to look this up to see what the heck they're talking about before I even comment. And I never did comment because it's just not worth it. I don't even care what other people think anymore. I'll do what I do. And if other people want to think what they want,
I just think people should
angry,
smile. I don't care what gender they are.
Well, that's my point. It's like, are they saying smile because they're a misogynistic or following patriarchy? Or are they saying it because, like you just said, like, you know, dude, you just be happy, you know, whatever. But either way, the point is people are taking things in a context that may be different than what the person that said it or wrote it intended.
Or even thought about while they were doing it. It's just like the age-old question in English classes of, does everything have a symbolism? I don't agree that everything does, you know.
That's fair too. Yeah, yeah. Because technically, you can say, you know, why is the did he say in the book that her sheets were yellow?
Right.
And it's like maybe he was just saying, well, I want to make a description. Let's just say they're yellow instead of plaid, you know. But maybe it was simple. But again, you're right. It doesn't. It's. Sometimes people overthink, and a lot of people are just angry people.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I disagree with Spike Lee or I agree with Spike Lee or this woman about smiling or not, but I just wanted to state that these things are out there, whether or not there's any merit behind them or if it's just over-eccentric people getting angry about nothing.
Well, and there are people that are going to see it that way, and that's their right, and that's how they read the book. I don't read the book that way, and I don't think that was Stephen King's intention, but I don't know that either because I'm not him.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, and fair enough. I mean, it is in his history that he's done it multiple times. I mean, we just named two examples here, The Stand and The Green Mile. But again, do I honestly believe he's a bigot? No. But do I think he's ignorant? I don't think so that either. But again, other people may have different perspectives.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be in the public eye, or actually, let me rephrase, if you're going to just be near a person, people are going to make judgments about what you do and what you say and how you act, even if none of it is true.
Yep.
And it doesn't even have to be famous, because it's not like the example about someone say, oh, you should smile. You're not famous no one's famous in that example. And yet someone's already judging somebody because they said something while that somebody may have been not implying anything except conversation.
So, yeah. I hate seeing you frown. You look unhappy. Is there anything I can do? You know what I mean? It's a lot to be read into that statement.
Right, right, right. And you know, as I made a running joke that in passing a little while ago, and people may have missed it because I said it while you were talking. You know, when I said that Ralph Brettner has been recast as by Irene Bedard, so a female, and also a woman of color, because she's a Native American individual, or at least partly anyway. And I said as a joke, is that cultural appropriation or even gender appropriation, because they changed it to somebody in a book, right? Because if it was the other way around, we would have an issue, right?
So yes, we would. I agree. And that's why I think there should be no changes. Don't change the book.
Right, right.
And I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek, by the way.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's just all ludicrously, and I say ludicrous not as in insulting anybody, but ludicrous in the sense that it's all ridiculously odd and hilarious and how people sometimes think. But
to me,
again,
they're not true criticisms. They're not criticizing like the story itself. They're criticizing the motivations of the writer. And I really don't like that, because you really don't know what a writer's motivations are.
Right. And also, is when Spike Lee points out and it says Hollywood, is he right to say that when they're adapting a book?
That too, yeah, exactly. That's a good point. But he's also part of Hollywood, so he has his own tropes and things that he does in his movies that I'm sure people are offended by.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, we'll let it go at that. We're not endorsing or either side, at least I'm not, and I think I'm willing to speak for you, because I think you're not either. So anybody who's upset with anything that was stated, they shouldn't be, because we're just stating what other people are saying and bringing it up, because again, we're talking about The Stand, and we're talking about what people have said about the magical Negro trope, and using analogies like the smiling thing and how it compares. So again, this is not us that believe or disbelieve or agree or disagree with it. We're just pointing it out.
Yep. And so every situation is different.
That's right. And if you have any
hate mail,
you cannot
generalize that statement and make it go to every time someone says you should smile.
That's
there might
right.
be
so
instances where someone is supporting the patriarchy.
That's right. So we're not mansplaining. We ain't religious splaining. We ain't gender splaining. We ain't ethnically, racially, sexually orientation splaining. We're just letting folks know what other people have mentioned.
Yep.
So keep your splaining to yourself and fuck you. We're not going to read your email if you send it. Okay, let's get into the CBS miniseries and what we feel about it. So this is going to be a nine. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking at the amount of episodes that they're in, and it looks like nine.
Yeah, so it jumped up to nine. The show is developed by Josh Boone. And he's actually directing the first and the last episode. Everybody else is to be announced. He's written a couple of the episodes, but he's the guy. He's the man. He's the big dude. And I'm assuming he's using him pronouns. Sorry, I just had to be a wise ass there. he is a person of mixed results. He did The New Mutants.
Have you seen it?
No. But
I haven't either, but I've heard it's horrible. I feel like I have to see it to say it's horrible, but...
people I know who I trust have said it's horrible. Okay. So I'll watch it when it comes out on free on HBO or Netflix or something, or Hulu or whatever. But yeah, I'm not going to spend any money for it. And he's done a bunch of other stuff that I've never heard of. But either way, he's the guy. Now, some of the casting. Stu Redman is played by James Marsden. I think that's
I love James Marsden.
Yeah, his career is had a huge bounce back with Westworld and Sonic Hedgehog. So I think this is an excellent pick. I could see him fitting perfectly, because he's got that Matthew McConaughey Texas type feel to him. So I'm good with that. Nadine Cross is played by Amber Heard. Now, a lot of folks don't like Amber Heard for some reasons related to a prior marriage that she had with a famous actor. I can understand that.
Yeah.
But let's disregard all of that, and let's just discuss her as Nadine Cross. I think she's too young for the role.
That's what I was thinking. Too young for the role.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm sure she'll be fine. Everything I've seen her in, whether people like her as a human being or not, I mean, that's not my point. My point is she a good actress? And everything I've seen her in, she's quite good. So,
well, and I was going to say, the one point I want to make about that is, do people deserve to have no career because they've made stupid choices in their lives? And, you know, how extreme do you go with that? And I'm never one that believes you should be ostracized from society for bad mistakes in your life.
Right, right. Well, you know what it is, though? It's the reason people don't like her is because you either like her or you like her, the ex. And if you like the ex, you hate her. And if you like her, you hate the ex. Because everything is related to one or two things. One is, he's a wife-beating scumbag mother bleeper. Or you're the other way, which is, she's a lying piece of crap, you know, on and on and on. So they both have – no one will ever know the truth. But
they only know the truth, that's for sure. And that's why people should stay out of it. And not try to destroy careers like either Johnny Depp's or hers.
And some of the things that are on record and on audio, for that matter, show her as not necessarily a
nice person.
Yeah, exactly. That's perfect. Thank you. So again, though, we're only talking about her as an actress and what you said, which is the private life, who cares? It's not our business. Let's just look at her.
Yeah, exactly. Not our business, and I don't think anyone deserves to have their career destroyed by something like this. There are things that people's careers could be destroyed over, but this is not, in my opinion, one of them. It should be private between the two of them, and that should be it.
That's right. Unfortunately, they want to go public with it, but what are you going to do?
Right.
We're not here to comment on that. So.
Right.
And if you have any problems about her or Johnny Depp and you want to email us, fuck you. We're not going to read it.
Yeah, don't. Please don't.
Okay. Now, Glenn Bateman. And this is the funny thing about Glenn Bateman. I could not stand how he was described in the book, because in the book, they're talking about how he has arthritis and he feels old. The guy's our age. He's 50 years old, you know, and then, you know, and so even the miniseries made him, the miniseries was better adaption than the book of him, because the way he's written in the book, he's not 50 or 55 years old. He's more like 70. And so when they cast the actor, I forget his name, in the miniseries from 1996, whenever it was, 94, that was a good casting, because he felt more like the character in the book was written.
I think Greg Kinnear is a good pick for Glenn Bateman.
I do too. Greg Kinnear is a great actor, and I'm
awesome.
I have no idea why he kind of faded out. He was A-lister for a while, and then he just faded out, and I don't understand why. I think he's fantastic. I do like his casting for Bateman, because If we go by the age written in the book, this is good.
He fits.
Kinnear,
he fits.
He fits. Now we'll see where they go with the character in the miniseries, and see how they're going to adapt them. But I hope they write off all the arthritis and all the old feeling old crap, because it doesn't work for someone that's 54 years old. Franny is played by Odessa Young. I don't know anything about her, so I can't comment on her.
I don't either. Her name's familiar to me, but I don't know from where.
Right.
Let's take a look. I'm going to look and see what she's in.
Nothing big. I mean, she's a good age, 22. That's the age she should be.
Yeah.
That's what she is in the book, or pretty close to it, so that's good. Otherwise, I don't know anything about her. She's a pretty girl, but... Doesn't show the sex appeal that Stephen King kind of wrote Franny as in the book, but I don't know. I mean, I'm just looking at a picture. I'd have to actually see her, you know, walking and talking and whatnot to see the charisma and all that. But all in all, Age-wise, seems fine. And I kind of always like the unknowns. I wouldn't mind it had they just cast all unknowns, similar to, like, or you know, B actors like you know, Star Wars or yep. Lord of the Rings had done. So this is fine.
She's of course Australian.
Of course, yeah, yeah. It's always like The Undoing. What do we? The joke that I keep on saying: every lead actor in The Undoing that are supposed to be all people from Manhattan, they're all the actors are from foreign countries. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Now Nick Andros is played by another unknown, Henry Azaga, who's a Brazilian actor. So. That's definitely way off base from a Midwestern American, but that's fine. Don't know anything about him. Whoopi Goldberg as Mother Abigail. I think that's fine. I have no issues with that.
Yeah, that fits.
Jovan Adepo plays Larry Underwood. So this is a big change. He's a British actor, a person of color. So a black British individual. So that's very different than the role in the book, but that's fine. I mean, I don't, you know, you do what you do. It doesn't matter. I don't like the character anyway, as I've been saying this whole episode. And so, you know, whoever they cast, it didn't matter to me. They could have cast my favorite actor, who would have been a 28-year-old Robert Duvall, and I'd still hate the character. Let's see. Owen Teague is playing Harold Lauder, and I don't know anything about this guy. He was in It Chapter 2. Teague played Patrick Hostetler.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Is that the bad guy, the villain?
He in the books, he's the serial killer that puts the animals in the fridges.
Okay. He's
not the main bad guy, but okay. He follows the main bad guy in the movies.
Gotcha.
Not really in the too much in the books.
Okay, so he's a fairly unknown folk.
Yeah.
Brad William Henke is Tom Cullen. I don't know much about him except that he was a professional football player, and he was in Orange is the New Black. He played for the Denver Broncos for 1 year, and then he played in the Arena League. I don't know what position he played. Yeah, let's see what position he played. It doesn't say what position he played, which is kind of weird. He had a lot of ankle injuries, so that's why his career kind of faded out in football. Yeah, well, I'd love to know what position he played. I'm a huge NFL fan.
He was in Split, too. Okay. Interesting. Okay, I recognize him now, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, obviously a big guy to play the role, which is interesting because they're going with the character in the original miniseries, because in the book, for folks who don't know, Tom Cullen was a small guy, a very small guy. But in the miniseries, they made him a huge character similar to the guy in Mice and Men, the mentally slow person in Mice and Men.
Yeah.
He's huge. He's like a huge guy in that story. And that's, they decided to base the Cullen character off of that rather than the Cullen character from the actual Stan novel. So it looks like they're going with the miniseries adaptation of Tom Cullen rather than the novel, which is fine with me.
Now, I find it interesting. I see Julie Lowry, which really is kind of a minor character in the book. She's in 9 episodes, which I find interesting.
That is interesting. And, well, you know what's funny is she was really awesome. Well, the woman that played her, Shawnee Smith, I think, played her in the miniseries. She was awesome. And her role feels big because of the miniseries, but you're right. In the book, her role is very small.
Yeah.
So they must have decided to build up more of the characters on the bad side.
I was thinking they might be showing Vegas a little more than we get in the book.
Yeah. And again, that's one of the faults I was talking about earlier,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yep.
70% of the second half of the book is Boulder rather than Vegas, you know?
Well, and who's going to want to take on a role that's only in there for, like, you know, 10 minutes of 9 episodes?
Right. yeah, exactly. So this woman here, Catherine McNamara, 25 years old. She... Based off of the picture I have here, she is the sex pot that they show in the book, as well as the sex pot that Shawnee Smith played her as. So the role, the casting looks pretty good because of that, because that's what the character's supposed to be. So yeah, I'm sure it's fine. Yep. Again, another unknown generally. Rita Blackmore is played by Heather Graham, who wasn't in the miniseries, but I loved her character in the book, and I felt her character was written too much in Larry's perspective, and Larry's such an asshole that I really didn't feel any anger at Rita as and her character in the book was weird too, because she's really strong and pretty level-headed the first chapter she's in, or the second chapter she's in, and then suddenly she becomes like this kook. And,
well, she starts relying on him, and he doesn't care about her.
Yeah, he's like a bad influence on her. I think she would have been
better. He kills
better
her. Off. He basically yeah. kills her because she becomes yeah. dependent on him, but he doesn't want to take responsibility for her.
right. Yeah, and I had she never met him, I think she could have survived all, you know, fine alone, because she seemed pretty level headed and knew what she was doing with, you know, the canned goods and all that prior to meeting him. And then he just fucks everything up for her.
Yeah.
And then Ralph Brettner is now changed to Ray. Don't ask me why they named him Ray and they just didn't name him a woman's name, because, like I said, Irene Bedard is a woman of color taking over the role. Dana Jurgens is played by Natalie Martinez. She's one of the people that are spies. They changed the Rat Man to Rat Woman. It's Fiona Dorf is playing that character.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And then, that's pretty much it. I mean,
The only other news we have is about Marilyn Manson. That was clarified today that he's not going to be in it. And we had thought he was going to maybe be the trash can man or the kid. And from the article I read on EW, it said that that was pulled, the whole thing with the kid. He was going to be playing the kid, and it just became too expensive, so they removed the kid scenes. And right. So Ezra Miller is going to be playing the trash can man.
Right, Ezra Miller is probably best known for We Need to Talk About Kevin. He played Kevin, and he's played a sociopath a number of times in films, including, I think, his film debut, and I forget the name of that film, but he's another school murderer in that film too. So yeah, he's a good actor. I like him,
and he plays the Flash.
Yeah, that's right. He does, doesn't he? But it is bizarre because, like we were talking about offline earlier, Miller would have been better as the kid, and Manson would have been better as Trash Can Man.
Yeah.
It would have been
good to leave the kid in, because I think it's a good set of scenes in the book. Even though it was cut from the original version of The Stand, it's one of the pieces I think most people that read the uncut version like.
Right. Yeah, well, whenever I talk to people that have read the book, meaning the extended book, and if that's the only version they've read, the character everybody talks about, everybody, is
yeah.
the kid. Even though he's only in like 6 chapters or so, his impression is huge, and he's become like a cult figure, you know, a cult character, you know, so you know, like how some random character in any movie becomes like a cult character, like Boba Fett did in Star Wars. You know, he was a small character, but everybody loved Boba Fett for some reason, and same with this book. When you read this book, everybody loves the kid because he's just an awesome sociopath riot. You know, I mean, that's why we named the podcast "Don't Tell Me, I'll Tell You." The Stan podcast was because you know it's a memorable line that he says throughout the book. So yeah, this is a major disappointment. When you told me this about 2 hours ago, when we were talking offline, I was devastated to hear this because that was one of the main reasons why I was looking forward to the miniseries or this new series is for the fact that though Marilyn Manson I would have liked because he could play a nice good sociopath too as we've seen in Son of Anarchy. I was really looking forward more specifically to see the interactions of the kid and the trash can man, and now that's not going to be there. Similar to like I remember when they were doing the Pet Sematary remake, that Stephen King, speaking of another Stephen King remake or book, they made that movie a year or two ago, and I was like, oh, this is good. They're going to finally fix all the crap they ruined in the movie before, because Judd's character in that book, he has a wife,
yep.
And that wife is pivotal in the book for a number of reasons.
Huge influence, yeah, for a lot of reasons.
Absolutely. And one of the best scenes in the book is her spirit being channeled through the Gage character at the end. And of course, that's not going to be in the first movie because they just wrote out that character. So I was like, oh my God, they're going to take her character. She's going to be in this new movie and it's going to make it awesome because they're going to do the friggin' scene in the book in the new film. And of course they don't. Because they didn't make her character. They did the same thing. It's like, yep. Are you kidding me? And now that's how I'm feeling about this now. So I'm not really looking forward to this miniseries as much as I was. Because,
yeah.
I mean, I like how it's 9 episodes. So, you know, the book is so big that you could make it like that. But you're going to eliminate the cult hero of the book?
Yeah, it could have just been in there for 5 minutes of film time. I mean, come on.
Right, exactly. You know, and I mean, you could have caught any cameo by any big actor that would have done it for nothing, just to be that because they're a fan of the book. You know, they could have Vin Diesel, who loves this shit. You know, he's a gamer, he's a geek, he's all that. Everybody doesn't know that, but you know, he plays Dungeons and Dragons and all that. He could have played the kid for like 10 minutes in the. Yeah, I'll do it for nothing. You know, I'll do it for, you know, just to have my name in it, and you know, and you know, that's just. And just write it out. It's like, are you fucking kidding me?
Bastards. Oh, we did forget to mention the Walking Dude is played by Alexander Skarsgård.
Okay, so, and you know what? That's okay. And I'll tell you what.
Yeah, I think he'll do a good job.
Yeah. I mean, the poor bastard keeps on getting typecast as a villain because he was a villain in True Blood and all that. And he almost became an A-lister, and then his career kind of faded out a little bit for some reason, similar to Marsden actually, but you know, yeah. maybe this will bump him back up to and you know, he is a good actor, so yeah, it may work, and it's kind of funny that Skarsgård's keep on making Stephen King films, you know, because I think they're brothers, you know, in real life.
Well, it's interesting because Alexander Skarsgård is in a movie with James Marsden. It's a remake. I can't think of the name of it. It's a horror movie.
Oh, really? That's funny.
Yeah, he's a writer, and James Marsden's a writer. He comes back to town, and yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of the movie.
Well, you can start looking it up while I continue talking about this. But
yeah, go ahead.
While you're looking it up, so I think that's a pretty good role because in the book, he's much younger. And he's kind of a better looking guy than the guy that was in the miniseries, but the guy that was in the miniseries was fine. I mean, he was awesome actually. But I could see Skarsgård fit in more the role that we saw in the book rather than the miniseries. So it makes sense, and he has that good look charisma that you would think people would be attracted to,
and the almost hint of madness he can show pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We saw that in True Blood, right? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. So that was a good sign too.
Straw Dogs is the name of the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the remake.
It was the remake, yeah, and it has James Marsden and Alexander Skarsgård.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Skarsgård plays the villain.
Yep.
I'll say one thing. We're old because Heather Graham playing Rita Blackmore.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. But you know what's funny, too? In the book, that's another character that in the book, Blackmore is portrayed as, you know, good looking, whatever, the first like couple of chapters. And then as we learn more about her, she's becomes, you know, like varicose veins and all this. And again, she's supposed to be only like 40 something.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what it is? I think it was Stephen King when he wrote the book was probably like 25 or 30 or something. And he just thought anybody over that was older than 45 was ancient or something. I don't get it.
Yeah.
That's all I can think of, because there's no way Bateman and Blackmore, as they were written in the book, would be the ages that he says they are.
No, I mean, I pictured Rita Blackmore as being more like 65 to 70 in the book.
Yeah, exactly. Even though she isn't supposed to be. She's only supposed to be 45 or something.
Like, she's trying to look 45, and so the makeup, when you get close looks, you can see that she's not really that young. You know what I mean? That's how I picture her from reading the book.
Right, right. And yet she's supposed to actually be 45, too.
Right, exactly.
But he's writing her as if she's 70 trying to look 45. That's kind of weird. Yeah. So that's – I don't know really what it's going to be like. And, you know, I mean, some of the changes – like Ray Brentner from Ralph Brentner and being a woman, I don't think that really matters because, like we said, his character is insignificant, really, even in the book. The other big change is Larry Underwood is being played by a black guy. And
that doesn't change anything either.
I don't really think that changes anything either, yeah, so it doesn't matter. And
And actually, if you're not paying attention in the book, you might think that he's a person of color.
That's true. But there's one thing that is going to be weird to see how that's going to work. Because in the book, his mother was what we call a different generational bigot. In other words, a person that is bigoted because of the generation they're from, not because they're really a bigot, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, my guess is there won't be any of that.
Right, because his mother's going to have to be – is most likely going to be black as well, right? So I don't –
Well, and even if they were white, I don't think it would be in there because of the way things are these days.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So the racist attitude of Larry's mother, because of the type of music that he likes to sing, won't be part of this story, which is fine with me because, I mean
– Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, Larry, like I said, I hated Larry in the book anyway, so I didn't really care about his backstory. I didn't care about his story, period. So anyway, any changes to Larry's fine with me because I think he'll be better than anything I saw in the book. So anything else you wanted to bring up about this new miniseries? Owen King is writing or co-writing at least three of the episodes. That's Stephen King's younger son. And then Stephen King and his younger son, Owen, are going to actually write the finale. And supposedly, this is another rumor, this is but from like 4 months ago. And again, that was when Trash Can Man and the kid were supposed to be in the film as Marilyn Manson. 4 months ago, I read that they're changing the ending completely. King wanted to change the ending to...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so to not have the same ending that was in the book or the miniseries that was in the 90s.
I'm not sure what I think of that.
Yeah, I guess this is him trying to say,
retcon.
Okay, fine, I see. Yeah, I see the problem that people think over the 30, 40 years since I wrote the book, because, yeah, it actually has been pretty close to 40 years. Maybe I've had better ideas that have come to my mind, and so I want to try one of them out in the miniseries. So that's what he's going to do. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to be a good miniseries, all right? I mean, it's a great source material, and the story's compelling, even with the nitpicks and the issues any of us have with it. But as we've seen in the past, a lot of Stephen King's adaptions on TV have been pretty crapola. Yeah. The Mist TV series was horrible. I never saw Under the Dome. I love the book, even though some people hated
it. I love the book too, but the miniseries the TV series was not great.
Yeah, I heard that was crapola. I know Castle Rock, which really is just using his universe. It's not really him, but I know that people liked it, but that already got dropped. Whether people watched it or not. Mr. Mercedes, I know people like that. I haven't seen that, but I don't know how long that's going to last because it has a limited viewing audience because of the station that it's on. It's not like a station everybody has.
Haven was based on the Colorado Kid, the Haven show.
Okay, and how was that?
I actually liked it. I thought it was fun, but it was very loosely based, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, so there's this hit and miss Stephen King adaptions. I know Hollywood, he's a name, and he's a cultural icon, not just a name. So Hollywood loves adapting his stuff, and they keep on going back to it. You know, and I can name dozens of authors that have had some really friggin' good work, and I'm not talking about, you know, indie authors. I'm talking about best-selling novels that are out there that never have been adapted and probably never will be adapted.
Yep.
And I have no idea why. But they love just going back to King. And again, no disrespect to King, but for whatever reason, they think the name Stephen King will help them sell. And it may. I mean, you know, that may be a better name than Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, you know, even though their books are great too.
I think that's changing a little bit though. I mean, with all the streaming services, they're all looking for different properties. So now we're seeing The Foundation is being made and things like that. Yeah. I think we're going to see a lot more shows just out there that are based on books that we didn't expect to ever see.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of Stephen King and adaptions of The Outsider, mm-hmm. the book, fucking great, except for the last 50 pages.
Yeah.
But I hated the miniseries because it.
I have not watched it because every time you say it's not great, so I haven't watched it.
So bad. I mean, you may like it. I have you read the book, The Outsider?
I read the book. It's been a while. I don't remember it very well. I read it. It's part of his detective series.
Yeah, loosely, because it has some characters from the Mr. Mercedes books, which I think was unfortunate because you knew that character wasn't going to die because it's a character that appears in all the books, right? But all the other characters were independent, so they could have died, so that part was good. But so it is loosely based because it does have one character from the Mr. Mercedes, even though it's not part of the Mr. Mercedes series.
Right.
That miniseries was well done. In the sense that the acting and the cinematography and the atmosphere, but it was a horrendous adaptation of the novel. It was a disgustingly bad adaptation. And again, you don't have to follow the source material to make a good story. As we've seen, you know, there's been changes. Like Lord of the Rings had some changes, and those movies were fine. We've seen Stephen King, some of his novels have been turned into movies that have been really good that don't follow the book. Both The Shining and Dr. Sleep do not follow the book 100%, neither of them, and both of those movies are good. So you can have that, but this here, it just literally, The Outsider, they literally just took the book and threw it into the dumpster. I was like, fucking pissed.
Well, and my big problem, my biggest pet peeve with not following the source material is when you add major scenes that are wholly created out of your own cloth that are not part of the book.
Right.
It did that. The new It did that a fair bit, and I didn't like it.
Yes, you mean the second part two.
Well, actually, even the first one had stuff in it. There were scenes that were not in the book.
That's true.
I did not like that.
Okay, see, I had no problems with the first movie because it was a great movie.
It was a great movie, but together those movies just fall flat.
Yeah, the second movie was so bad. I was not a fan of it at all. I was so disappointed. I was like, oh my God. You know, I don't know. But you know what? I think the first movie was a little lucky because the first movie was being ripped to shreds in the press and you know, magazines about how behind the scenes chaotic and horrible everything was going.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow when they put it together and released it, it was good. And so I'm thinking it was like a perfect storm where everything was shit, but they lucked out and it became awesome.
Yeah.
So I think it was lucky, especially since their prior movie, which was called Ma or whatever it was friggin' terrible, that when the second one came out, which was probably kind of filmed along with the first one, it probably had the same chaotic crap, and it kind of was what was probably how the first one should have been, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it was more apt it was going to be crap than good, and the first one just became good because everything fell into place correctly, even with all the issues that were happening around it.
Yeah.
So I know what you're saying. Also, I think the second one, they shouldn't have cast that actress, that famous actress. I think they should have just went with all unknowns, similar to what they did with the kids.
I agree.
Anyway, that's off topic to this, but we're using them as analogies of how we just don't know, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to try to be. We're going to try to be unbiased when we talk about each episode of the miniseries. Like, for example, we did that with Lovecraft Country and The Undoing, the two other podcasts that we did prior. We did a podcast called A Travel Guide to Lovecraft Country, the podcast, which was based off of the mini series or season one of the HBO television series Lovecraft Country. And we honestly gave our honest opinions and we're unbiased. We weren't, you know, trying to trash anything or suck up to anything. We were looking at it and saying, this is what we thought. And then with The Undoing, the same thing, which was The Undoing, a therapy session podcast. And that was another HBO series. And we did the same thing. And our conclusion was that the Lovecraft Country, we had a lot of issues with, and we said why. And The Undoing, we liked a whole lot, and we said why. And again, it was all unbiased. We went in blind for both series. And that's what we're going to kind of do here. Obviously, here, we know the source material, so we may
obviously we'll be biased no matter what we can do, I mean, to a degree.
Yeah.
Because we know how much we like the source material, so it's going to affect us.
Exactly.
But we'll try to take into account the medium and what they're trying to attempt to do in so many episodes, and we'll see how they do. I mean,
yeah,
I'm going into it not knowing how they're going to do, and hopefully they do a great job. I'm really hopeful for it.
Yeah, I was up until about 2.5 hours ago when you told me they are losing the kid and all that. So I'm very disappointed now. You also mentioned that they had a Doors song, the end, which is actually probably my second favorite Doors song.
Yeah.
And the Doors is probably my favorite band of all time. And Marilyn Manson and Shooter Jennings did a version of the song, and it was supposed to be part of the miniseries.
Yeah,
and they would use it, which it's a great song for any miniseries, no matter who does it. And that got yanked too because they couldn't afford the rights to that. And both Marilyn Manson and Shooter Jennings are huge names, so okay, they're going to be expensive. But is just interesting. Where I wonder what they cut, what else they could have cut Connors on instead of Trash Can Man, the kid, and the end. You know,
I mean, the end especially, those would be a perfect song for this movie, and Marilyn Manson does great covers. So who at the studio decided that we can't afford this song?
Right. Yeah.
Just seems boneheaded to me.
Right, right. Yeah, and I know the two surviving members of the Doors, as well as the estates of the other two, have been pretty liberal with the song usage.
Mm-hmm.
But so I don't think it's related to them. So I don't think it's related to Robbie Krieger or John Densmore or Morrison's or Manzarek's estates. So I'm thinking it's more related to Jennings and Manson's price. But again, I can't believe
they had to know that going in.
Exactly. They must have known this 8 months ago or a year
right.
ago. Because Manson, I remember seeing when I first heard about this series, Wikipedia had Manson listed, literally had his name listed as Trash Can Man. Okay.
Yeah.
And then about 4 months ago, when we recorded the Stand episode, the first episode of this podcast, his name was still there, but they removed Trash Can Man. It just said, you know, actor starring, and they had people listed and who they were playing, but they just had Manson's name, but they didn't have the character. So what was probably happened was he was going to be the kid at that time. They switched him over to the kid, maybe, because that's what you were kind of saying that he was originally cast for. And then he's now gone completely from the Wikipedia page. And you mentioned the article that was released today that said that they removed his entire arc, as well as his song that he either co-sang, written, or whatever with Jennings. But no matter what, I'm sure Jennings produced it, because Jennings does a lot of production too, because he, even though he's a country musician, he actually produces like heavy metal. He produces everything, and he's a big into production, never mind his own music. So
let me clarify one thing. The kid was a casualty because Manson wasn't able to make that work schedule-wise.
Okay. Interesting.
But the Doors song was too expensive to use.
Right. Well, and that still doesn't make any sense that Manson couldn't have it work schedule-wise because, again,
couldn't take that much time up.
Right. Well, and he was listed way back as signed, right?
Yeah.
Right, I mean, he was listed on the wikis. He was listed on
everything. Yeah,
yeah. So it wasn't
that was one of the draws.
Yeah, you're damn right. It was. You know, that would have been awesome. So
and they knew it was a draw. Otherwise, they wouldn't have let that out.
Exactly. And I'm not a huge Manson fan. I don't really listen to his music. I did buy his Greatest Hits album, and one other album. Way
I'm a huge Manson fan, so
okay. Yeah, so for you,
twice.
So for me, he was more. I was big into it because I just thought he was perfect casting. You know,
yeah.
I had seen him in Son of Anarchy, playing a sociopath there. Never mind. You know, his music videos. Even though I'm not a big fan of him, I've seen some of his music videos. So I thought it was a great casting. So I was into it. That was huge, but it's gone.
Oof. Yep.
Kind of sucks.
It does.
Yeah. Well, anyway, anything else on the CBS All Access series that you wanted to bring up? Because we just went over the characters and a couple of changes, but we didn't really talk about anything else.
No, I think we're going to have to see how and where they go with this. I'll be interested in what our thoughts are on the first episode. Really looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the first episode I figure is going to be good, because a lot of TV series, the first episodes are usually good because that's where they put a lot of their money in. But
Lovecraft Country, it was the best episode for a while.
Yeah. I mean, there's some exceptions, you know, like Game of Thrones had a really good first episode, but it wasn't like crazy over the top action or anything like that. It was just a good drama and stuff. But here, it'll be curious to see the Apocalypse happen. And also, I'm curious who's going to play the Ed Harris
general.
The general.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be interesting too. I wonder if there's any surprises that they're not letting out yet, and that we're gonna just suddenly find out, you know. But
that's true. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. So for folks who are curious, we're recording this episode on November 24th, 2020, and the first episode of the season is December 17th. So by the time you listen to this, though, this episode will be released. Most likely December 11th or 12th. So you'll be hearing it then. So we're talking about this in the mode of November 24th. So there could be almost a whole month from now that there's still different news that could pop out that we don't know yet. So,
yep.
So whatever we're saying now, it could already be dated by the time you hear this. Anyway. All right. So I guess we'll wrap it up then. Let's give our final thoughts on the book first, and then our final thoughts on what we're hoping that the CBS Access does. So I'll start with the book myself. The book is really solid. I don't like the book as much as Barrett, because he said it's his second favorite Stephen King book, which is lofty to say, especially when he has so many books that are awesome. And I mentioned like four or five that are awesome that I thought were better than The Stand. But either way, it's a damn good book. I've read it twice. And I don't usually read books more than once unless I really want to. And I decided this was good enough to read a second time. And actually, I think it's only the third Stephen King book I've read twice. Pet Sematary and The Salem Slot were the other two. I wouldn't mind reading out The Outsider again, actually. But either way, the book's really solid. Has some issues, as we discussed, but don't have that scare you away. And make sure you read the extended edition, because it has the character of the kid, and it has a lot more of the Trash Can Man as well. Your final thoughts on the book?
The book is very solid. Like Phil said, it's probably number two as far as my list of Stephen King books. Now, he did bring up a lot of really good ones. So, I've read every book by Stephen King up to a certain point. Like in the last couple of years, he's come out with some that I haven't read. But so it's really, you're talking about a lot of books, so it's kind of hard to rate. But I would put it up there as my number two, and it is my favorite. But this book is solid. Read it. Read the uncut version. You got to get the kid in there. It's a fun read. It does have some flaws. It's not perfect. I don't think any book is perfect. But you'll enjoy it if you read it.
All right. Well, for the CBS miniseries, or not, it's not really that many, 9 episodes. It'll be curious to see if the rumors that Stephen King is changing the ending, how that'll happen. It'll be more interesting to see the Apocalypse longer. I hope they focus more on the Apocalypse than the dystopia aftermath. I also hope to see more of Las Vegas. And it'll be curious to see if they turn the people in Las Vegas as cliche, over-the-top villains, or the human characters that they appeared to feel like in the book. Again, a lot of it is just wait and see. But I will admit that I am really not looking forward to it as much as I was just a few hours ago, because of what's happened with the kid and all that. So losing that whole side story really upsets me a lot. So I have to admit that I am now going into it not as thrilled as I would have yesterday. Barrett?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I am disappointed at that news that I found. I'm sorry to have told you about it, because I didn't want to bring down your enthusiasm, but, you know, it is what it is, and it's not going to change, so got to accept that, and I'm hoping that, like you, more of it's about the apocalypse and then the rebuilding portion, but we'll see. It looks like we may get a little more of Las Vegas from what we're seeing in the cast and how many episodes certain people are in. So we'll see. I'm going to have high hopes, and hopefully they are matched.
Yeah, very good. For folks who are listening, just for explanation of how and why we're doing it the way we're doing it, originally we were, again, just going to do a one episode just on the review of the book. And that was going to be part of the Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Review podcast, which is a general podcast about genre material, or art house films and horror films, science fiction, whatever, movies, books, and so forth. And it's usually, generally it was once a month, but due to other commitments with other podcasts, it usually falls away while we do other podcasts. So when we were doing the Lovecraft Country and the Undoing podcast, the Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Review podcast kind of goes on hiatus. But what happens was is that we were going to do the book episode, but we were talking about the first half of the book so long, we decided to break it into two, and that's why we have the two episodes. And then what happened is we decided to take these two episodes and use it as an intro to the CBS Access podcast that we're doing, which again is called Don't Tell Me, I'll Tell You, The Stand, the podcast. And what's happening is it's going to be under two feeds, at least for these two episodes for the book. And the reason for that is to get a podcast onto Apple Podcasts or Google or Stitcher or wherever you listen to podcasts, it takes sometimes a couple of weeks depending on the service you use. So for example, Stitcher, the podcast usually gets accepted within maybe 4 hours, but Google Play, sometimes it takes 3 weeks, and Apple, it's usually only 3 days. So it varies. And so Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews already has a feed set up ready to go. We just load up the podcast and it appears automatically on all those, places. While the Don't Tell Me, I'll Tell You, the Stand podcast feed is in fluctuation. It's already on Stitcher, most likely, by the time you listen to this, but Google Play, it's still probably in their queue to accept. So by having it, these two in this feed, the Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Roof feed, it still gets out to you folks. And to have it also in the feed for Don't Tell Me, I'll Tell You, the Stand podcast, it allows us to submit something to Apple and Google and Stitcher and Spotify and iHeartRadio and all the rest, so they can set it up and have it hopefully available by the 17th for everybody in all those platforms. So that's the reason why these two episodes especially are actually under both podcasts, and that's just the explanation to help folks understand what goes on behind the scenes to create a podcast feed and to have it appear on any of those platforms that I just mentioned. I guess that's pretty much our episode for tonight. So that's the book episode and our thoughts on CBS. We'll be back by the time this is released, it'll be, like I said, around the 12th. So we'll be back next week to discuss the first episode of The Stand. And that actually is called The End. So it appears that it's going to start, the apocalypse is going to start right away, pretty much similar to the miniseries. Because, again, the book starts with the bug escaping, right? So that's what's going to happen here. I forget the name of the character that is Patient Zero. I forget his name. I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't think of it either. Yeah.
Yeah. Campion.
Campion. That's it. Yep.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah, so either way, it'll be curious too to see if the Campion will be a named actor that has a cameo, or they just get some character actor. But either way, we'll be back next week to discuss the first episode. We're not sure what day we're going to start recording, and we don't know what day we're going to release. When we get closer to the 17th, we'll decide. 17th is on a Thursday, so we're probably going to maybe record episodes maybe the 21st, I'm thinking. I don't know. That would be Mondays. Maybe we record them on Mondays. I don't know. And then release it on the Tuesday.
Yeah, that might work.
Yeah, but we'll discuss offline. But either way, you'll see a new episode each week, no matter what day. And when we get into the flow, we'll let you know the general day of the week that the episode will be released. But either way, if you subscribe to any of the RSS feeds for this podcast, it'll automatically pop up in your queue when it is available. And you usually will get a message from that service that the episode has appeared if you subscribe. So I guess with that, thank you for listening. And also any emails, darkdiscussions@aol.com, or go to darkdiscussions.com and the contact us and email us that way. And we will read your episodes. I mean, your messages on the episode. So Barrett, why don't you let us out?
Thank you for joining us on this discussion of The Stand, the uncut version of the book. And join us for the miniseries as we discuss each episode weekly.
Yeah, when I was only 17, I could hear the angels whispering. So I drove into the woods and wandered aimlessly about until I heard my mother shouting through the fog. It turned out to be the howling of a dog, or a wolf to be exact. The sound sent shivers down my back, but I was drawn into the pack, and before long they allowed me to join in and sing their song. So from the cliffs and higher still, yeah, we would gladly get our fill, howling endlessly and shrilly at the dawn. And I lost the taste for judging right from wrong, for my flesh had turned to fur, yeah, and my thoughts, they surely were turned to instinct and obedience to God. You can wear your fur like a river on fire, but you better be sure if you're making God a liar. I'm a rattlesnake, babe, I'm like fuel on fire. So if you're gonna get made, don't be afraid of what you learn. On the day that I turned 23, I was curled up underneath the dogwood tree, when suddenly a girl, her skin the color of a pearl, she wandered aimlessly, but she didn't seem to see. She was listening for the angels just like me. So I stood and looked about, I brushed the leaves off of my snout, and then I heard my mother shouting through the trees. You should have seen that girl go shaky at the knees. So I took her by the arm, we settled down upon a farm, and raised our children up as gently as you please. But now my fur has turned to skin, and I've been quickly ushered in to a world that I confess I do not know. But I still dream of running careless through the snow, through the through the howling wind that blow across the ancient distant flow, and fill our bodies up like water till we know. You can wear your fur like a river on fire, but you better be sure if you're making God a liar. I'm a rattlesnake, babe, I'm like fuel on a fire. So if you're gonna get made, don't be afraid of what you learn.